Exodus 8:20 through 9:12. The 10th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on June 2, 1996 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
I hope you'll be able to hear me above the roar of my fans. We're working on the second triad of plagues in Exodus. I haven't figured out yet what these plagues are all about. I'm working on it. I'm hoping that I figure it out before I'm done teaching on it. But it's like a big puzzle. There are lots of pieces here, and I can see the pieces, but I'm having trouble figuring out how they all fit together. I think it's important because Exodus devoted about 5 chapters to talking about these 10 plagues and goes into considerable detail. But what is the significance of these plagues? What is the significance? Why did God choose to have these particular plagues? Why in this order? Why do we have the descriptions of Pharaoh's responses the way they are? Why do we have all the details that we have, and how do you make sense of all those details? And I haven't found the key yet, but I'm convinced that there is a reason for the description that we have. The existing description, as we find it in Genesis, didn't just happen. It was composed, and it was composed with purpose. One thing that seems evident to me is that there is a pattern to the plagues and the way that each one is presented. And I, having looked at Genesis and the 7 days of creation, it seems pretty clear to me that in the description of each day, there is also a pattern. There, the pattern is clearer, it's less cluttered, and you can sort out what's happening each day, the differences between the days. And I think that those differences are significant, and that the differences have theological significance. That the pattern there is important to understand the creation narrative. I suspect that the same is true here. However, the pattern is much more complex, much harder to sort out, and therefore it's difficult to determine what its theological significance is. My suspicion is that if we had more background, if we knew more about the Egyptian religion, if we knew more about Egyptian customs, that more of the pieces would fall into place. I suspect that part of the problem is a lack of background information. And I always hope that that's a problem elsewhere in the Old Testament. This isn't the only place where a dearth of background information is a problem. My hope is that as more and more things are discovered in the Near East archaeologically, that more light will be shed on these passages. But until then, I think it's a matter of noticing the right clues in these passages, the clues to the pattern. Why? What's going on? What is the author focusing on and drawing our attention to? And in determining that pattern, I think we can benefit a lot from others. I have been reading several different commentaries, hoping that I can find some direction. But I haven't been terribly satisfied. I'm finding a pattern in the commentaries, Conservatives who write commentaries typically don't pay much attention to the text, which is unfortunate. Liberals who write commentaries just take the text apart. They split it up into the various oral traditions, and then they look at each oral tradition separately. As a result, they don't work at finding the unity or the coherence to a passage, and that's the very thing that I'm most interested in. So what I've been doing, the commentaries that I've been relying on more than anything else, are Jewish commentaries. There's a modern Jewish commentary that I have looked at repeatedly, and there's one, I think it dates back to the Middle Ages, that have been more helpful than the other commentaries. But still, I've been frustrated because what the Jewish commentaries typically do is they have paid attention to the pattern here, and they've tried to point out things, pieces of the pattern that they see. But there's a lot of emphasis in the Jewish commentaries on looking for how many times a word is repeated in a particular section or related words. And almost a minute detail attention to details that I have trouble finding significance to. So I haven't found any place that's been completely revelatory. So back to the text. Let me review what the pattern seems to be in the first triad of miracles. Now, I've talked about the triad. There are nine miracles, and then the tenth is the killing of the firstborn. But in the first nine miracles, there does seem to be a pattern. They're divided up into threes. And this is something that virtually all of the Jewish commentaries point out, that it appears as though the first three miracles are a unit, then you go to the next three miracles, and then the next three. In the first miracle, where Moses turned the water of the Nile to blood, let me just point out these elements in the description of that miracle, that plague. And some of these may or may not be significant. I'm not sure. Some of these are ones that the Hebrew commentaries have pointed out, and some of them are not. But the most distinctive thing about these triads is in the first plague of each triad, Moses is directed to go to meet Pharaoh when he goes in the morning out to the Nile. So as Pharaoh gets up in the morning and goes out to the Nile, Moses is supposed to meet him there. That happens in the first plague, that happens in the fourth plague, and that happens in the seventh plague. In the second plague, God tells Moses, go to Pharaoh. Just go to Pharaoh. That happens in the second plague, that happens in the fifth plague, and that happens in the eighth plague. Then in the third plague, no announcement whatsoever. God just tells Moses, do plague X. Plague 3. So that happens in the third plague, that happens in the sixth plague, and in the ninth plague. So that's the overall tip-off to the fact that they seem to be in triads. Okay, just let me mention some things that come out of the description of the first three plagues, and we'll see if later on, if this can be helpful. As I mentioned, Moses goes to Pharaoh by the Nile in the morning. He announces to Pharaoh that he has been sent by Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews. Then when he performs the plague, Aaron is instructed to stretch out his staff. Now that is something that's in common in all of the first three plagues. And then after that, Aaron's staff is no longer mentioned. It's only in the first three. The commentaries point out that the Nile was considered to be a god by the Egyptians. So the first plague is one that's proclaimed in direct opposition to one of the Egyptian gods. And this miracle, or this phenomenon of turning the water of the Nile into blood, the text points out, is something that the magicians could do. So the first plague is one that the magicians could do. But Pharaoh wasn't impressed, and the language that's used at the conclusion of the first plague is that Pharaoh's heart was hardened. Okay, those seem to be the features that either do or do not have a parallel in the other miracles. The second plague was one of frogs, and it's generally suggested that the turning the water of the Nile to blood, and then all of the commentaries that I looked at take that to be they made it that the in this plague the water of the Nile was turned red color rather than actual blood, than the actual substance blood. And I think that doesn't sound implausible to me. The second one, then, is often suggested was a consequence of the first plague. That is, the water was turned red, and there was apparently something in the water that gave it the red color. It's something that the commentaries point out happens yearly. When the flooding starts, the water of the Nile generally turns red because soil that it's washing down is red. But in this instance, it was peculiar in that apparently it was deadly to the fish in the water. It was not just a typical flood situation, which does not hurt the fish, but rather this time it's deadly to the fish, and the fish die, start to rot, and apparently deprive the water of oxygen or whatever else frogs need to live, and they climb out of the water. So the second plague then seems to be a consequence of the first. It's frogs going absolutely everywhere. Now, it is typical for the frogs to leave the water at this time of year, but not in such numbers and not going so far and going everywhere. In the second miracle, Moses is told to go to the Pharaoh. He comes representing Yahweh rather than Yahweh, God of the Hebrews. Again, to start this plague, Aaron is instructed to stretch out his rod. Again, the frogs were considered to be a god by the Egyptians. And again, the magicians were able to perform this same feat. The text tells us that. Now, at this, once the frogs are all over the place, Pharaoh called for Moses to get rid of the frogs. He called Moses back in. He says, yeah, I'll let the people go. Sure, fine, no problem. Ask Moses to pray. Moses prayed. The frogs died in place, but at least they were no longer crawling around, I guess. And then it says, he hardened his heart, is the phrase that is used. And Pharaoh did not let the Israelites go. The third plague was gnats. In this instance, Aaron again was told to stretch out his staff and touch the dust of the earth, and gnats spread throughout all of Egypt. I'll stop and tell a story here. I can't resist. We were in Klamath Falls, one of my former hometowns, and when we were there, they had lots of mosquitoes, and they used to spray for mosquitoes. I don't know what they sprayed with. I can't say that it affected the population of the city, but it may have. But they decided that rather than spray, that it was better to bring in this other creature called a midgie. And this midgie was brought in from South America, a wonderful critter. It eats mosquito larvae. So they brought it in. Midgies do not bite you. They land on you just like a mosquito, tickle you like a mosquito, and then eventually fly away like a mosquito. but they don't bite you, so it's a big improvement. We went back to visit Klamath Falls, and after a day of working, cleaning up our house, we went to have some Kentucky Fried Chicken at a Kentucky Fried Chicken place, and we couldn't tell for sure whether it was open or closed. The lights were on, but they were on dimly. So we drove up, and we were trying to determine whether it was opened or closed, and we could see the people motioning to us to go around to the back. So we drove around to the back, and they turned all the lights on out in front. Then they opened the door in the back, and we snuck in and had a fine meal. The reason the lights were dim was because there were so many midges on the neon sign that it was kind of half power. So Klamath Falls had dealt with the problem of mosquitoes. Okay, so the third miracle, gnats were all over the place. I can imagine the scene. The magicians could not do this. No practice, probably. The magicians could not reproduce this one. So this is the first one that the magicians could not do. And so they turn to Pharaoh and they say, it must be the finger of God. They don't say Yahweh. They don't say God of the Hebrews. And they don't say the hand of God. This is the finger of God. And then the language that's used at the conclusion is, Pharaoh's heart was hardened. Okay, so those seem to be the features that we've got working in the first triad. Now let's look at the second triad and talk about those features, and then you guys can help me figure out what's going on here. Chapter 8, verse 20. This is the fourth plague. Now the Lord said to Moses, "Rise early in the morning and present yourself before Pharaoh as he comes out to the water. And say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go, that they may serve me. For if you will not let my people go, behold, I will send swarms of insects on you and on your servants and on your people and into your houses. And the houses of the Egyptians shall be full of swarms of insects and also the ground on which they dwell. But on that day I will set apart the land of Goshen, where my people are living, so that no swarms of insects will be there, in order that you may know that I, the Lord, am in the midst of the land. And I will put a division between my people and your people. Tomorrow this sign shall occur." Then the Lord did so, and there came great swarms of insects into the house of Pharaoh and the houses of his servants. And the land was laid waste because of the swarms of insects in all the land of Egypt. In this plague, the fourth, as we would expect then according to the pattern, that Moses is told to go down in the morning to meet Pharaoh by the Nile. Now the person he is sent representing Yahweh. He speaks in the name of Yahweh, rather than Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews. Now, what exactly this plague is not clear. The word that's used for the insects occurs only in this passage in Hebrew. The stem seems to mean, let's see, what did the stem mean? The stem seems to mean devour, I think. So there were some ancients who interpreted this to mean wild animals. But the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, translates this as stable fly. The stable fly, otherwise known as Stomoxys calcitrans, whatever that is a fly that inhabits tropical and subtropical areas. And under the right conditions, it can proliferate and become a real pest. It has a tendency to carry a number of diseases that affect several different animal species, including cows and camels. So it's believed that that's what this plague was a spreading of this stable fly. Another feature of this stable fly is that it doesn't live in a Mediterranean climate. Now, according to the Old Testament text, the Hebrews were moved into Goshen, which is northeast from the heart of Egypt. And it has more of a Mediterranean climate. Egypt proper has a tropical climate. So this fly does not live in Goshen. In that area of Egypt, it doesn't inhabit that area. Which could make sense of what God says when he says that he will make a division between his people and the Egyptians. That this plague is going to be a smart bomb. This plague is going to affect the Egyptians, but not the Israelites. The other plagues, it doesn't make it clear whether the Israelites are affected by the plague or not. But in this one, and we'll see in subsequent ones, several subsequent ones, but not all of them, it indicates that the plague is specifically directed towards the Egyptians and not the Israelites. So this is a very focused plague, geographically. Furthermore, a definite time is set for this plague, as opposed to the other plagues. And God gives a reason for this plague in verse 22. But on that day I will set apart the land of Goshen, where my people are living, so that no swarms of insects will be there, in order that you may know that I, the Lord, am in the midst of the land. So apparently, he's going to give several different reasons for this plague. They're all slight variations on the same theme. But in this instance, God is saying that I am here. I have a presence right here in Egypt. And he wants to underscore that point. He's not just a god over there, where the Hebrews came from. Okay, with this plague then, Pharaoh just calls Moses back. This is a nasty one. Pharaoh doesn't like it. Let's see. Let's read this next section, verse 25 through 32. And Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, "Go, sacrifice to your God within the land." But Moses said, "It is not right to do so, for we shall sacrifice to the Lord our God what is an abomination to the Egyptians. If we sacrifice what is an abomination to the Egyptians before their eyes, will they not then stone us? We must go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Lord our God as he commands us." And Pharaoh said, "I will let you go, that you may sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness. Only you shall not go very far away. Make supplication for me." Then Moses said, "Behold, I am going out from you, and I shall make supplication to the Lord that the swarms of insects may depart from Pharaoh, from his servants, and from his people tomorrow. Only do not let Pharaoh deal deceitfully again in not letting the people go to sacrifice to the Lord." So Moses went out from Pharaoh and made supplication to the Lord. And the Lord did as Moses asked and removed the swarms of insects from Pharaoh, from his servants, and from his people. Not one remained. But Pharaoh hardened his heart this time also, and he did not let the people go. So Pharaoh calls Moses back again. So this is the second time that Pharaoh has been concerned enough by the effects of the plague, of a plague, that he calls Moses back. And his first suggestion is that don't go too far away. You can stay right here in Egypt and sacrifice to your God. My suspicion is that he is picking up on the clue where God had said that the purpose of this was to show that he is in the midst of the land. I suspect Pharaoh's saying, well, if God is here, if your God is here in Egypt, you can just worship him here. You don't need to go anywhere. But Moses' response is, no, we can't do it here. What God asks, it may be that what God will ask us to do will be reprehensible to you Egyptians. God has told us to go into the wilderness, a 3 days' journey. The Hebrew commentaries say that a 3 days journey is a literary device for a long trip. I don't know whether that's the case or not. So Pharaoh is still he's still desperate. He says, okay, go, but don't go far. I will let you go that you may sacrifice the Lord your God in the wilderness, only you shall not go very far away. So make it a quick trip. You can go, just make it a quick trip. Don't go very far. Then his next sentence is wonderful. Make supplication for me. His biggest concern is the effect that this is having on him. He's a wonderful ruler, keeping in mind the well-being of his subjects. He asks for Moses' prayer for him. And that seems to be his main concern, is to what extent are these plagues affecting me personally? That seems to have the greatest impact on him. But Moses does pray for him, and the flies abate. They leave both Pharaoh and all of his people. But Pharaoh's heart is hardened. It says Pharaoh hardened his heart. Okay, the next plague, plague number 5. Chapter 9, verse 1. Then the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh and speak to him. Thus says the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, let my people go, that they may serve me. For if you refuse to let them go and continue to hold them, behold, the hand of the Lord will come with a very severe pestilence on your livestock, which are in the field, on the horses, on the donkeys, on the camels, on the herds, and on the flocks. But the Lord will make a distinction between the livestock of Israel and the livestock of Egypt, so that nothing will die of all that belongs to the sons of Israel. And the Lord set a definite time, saying, tomorrow the Lord will do this thing in the land. So the Lord did this thing on the morrow. And all the livestock of Egypt died, but the livestock of the sons of Israel, not one died. And Pharaoh sent, and behold, there was not even one of the livestock of Israel dead. But the heart of Pharaoh was hardened, and he did not let the people go. This fifth plague then, again, as we would expect in the second of the triad, he just says, go to Pharaoh. This time, Moses is representing Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews. This time, again, there is a distinction that is being made. This time, again, there is a definite time set for when this will happen. Now, with this one, the commentaries point out that several, if not all, of the animals that are affected by this plague were sacred to the Egyptians. The cow was sacred to the Egyptians. Can't remember which other ones were. But apparently some of these were sacred to the Egyptians. And so that could be a significant feature of this particular plague. Notice that if it is true that the previous plague was the stable fly, which only inhabits Egypt proper, and is a fly that carries a number of diseases that can be communicated to other animals, then it could be that they bit those animals, and then the sickness then strikes those animals and they start dying in Egypt proper and not in Goshen. Yes?
Is there hyperbole in this text? Because it says all the livestock die, but later on you have the firstborn.
Yes.
Livestock.
Yes.
So it just means a huge amount.
Yes, yes. And that's, there are several instances of that. Later on it says that we have something killing all the plants. Just a second. We have the hail killing all the plants. And then we have the locusts coming in and killing all the plants. Right after the next plague after that. So there seems to be hyperbole throughout this account. And we have heavy use of the word all in times when it's clearly not all from the subsequent description.
When you run into people who don't have a very high view of Scripture, they point out stuff like this, and they say, you know, obviously the Bible can't be inerrant because you can't count on it to be consistent from one verse to the next, and they point out stuff like this, and you tell them that you've got literary devices here, like hyperbole, which are not limited to the Bible and are accepted elsewhere, so why can't we have hyperbole here? And it would be a pretty stupid author that would contradict himself within the space of a couple of minutes reading.
Mm-hmm.
And they just kind of laugh at you like, well, you're going to believe what you're going to believe. Do you have any better approach to that?
No. No. But I think it's important for us to note these features of the text, because what we need to do is figure out what kind of genre is this? What kinds of things happen in this text? Therefore, how should we interpret these things? Because if God means all in the sense of absolutely everyone, then we need to, if that's what was intended by the author, that's the way we need to interpret it. But if it's being used hyperbolically, then we need to interpret it that way. And it has been, the commentaries point out that this whole account of the plagues has a poetic quality to it. And I'm willing to take their word for it. I don't claim to know the sound of Hebrew well enough to determine that sort of thing. But we do see the kind of repetition, a bit of the repetition. It's not as clear as we see it elsewhere, but there is a bit of that. And I think that this could indeed be poetic. And if it's poetic, then we have to interpret it as Hebrew poetry was intended to be understood.
So when they say poetry, they don't mean as in contrast to history. They mean it is a way of presenting history.
Right, that it is a genre. Yeah, not that it did not happen, but rather it is a genre, a form of literature in which this particular section of Exodus is being presented. It would be like, you can have poetry that is historically accurate. There are a lot of poems that relate truly historical events as they occurred. Those two aren't incompatible. And this is as if, then, the author of Exodus started out in historical narrative, then when we get to the plagues, broke off and stuck a poem in here relating that that material, and then breaks off again and moves into historical narrative. But I think that's plausible. If that is the case, then we have to take into account how Hebrew poetry ought to be understood and interpreted accordingly. Okay, then the sixth plague in Exodus 9:8-12. Then the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Take for yourselves handfuls of soot from a kiln, and let Moses throw it toward the sky in the sight of Pharaoh. And it will become fine dust over all the land of Egypt, and will become boils, breaking out with sores on man and beast through all the land of Egypt." So they took soot from a kiln and stood before Pharaoh, and Moses threw it toward the sky, and it became boils, breaking out with sores on man and beast. And the magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils, for the boils were on the magicians as well as on all the Egyptians. So as the pattern would dictate, then, this is the third in this triad of plagues. There is no announcement made to Pharaoh whatsoever. Again, well, in the third plague, it was the dust that Aaron was to strike with this rod. Here, they're supposed to take soot from the kilns and throw it in the air. But it says it will become fine dust over all the land of Egypt. So we have dust involved again in this plague. Curiously, they're supposed to take the soot from the kiln. Presumably, this is a kiln that was used to bake bricks. So there may be a connection here between this plague and the slavery to which the Israelites were being subjected to in Egypt. And then a little comic relief in verse 11. Here we have the magicians who have boils over themselves. They too are being afflicted by this plague just like all of the other Egyptians. And they are so afflicted they can't even stand before the Pharaoh. So they now are victims of this plague just as much as anyone else. They have no defense against it. And then it says, and the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. So Yahweh hardened Pharaoh's heart. Inclusion of this plague. The plague seemed to be progressively more difficult to pull off, difficult to replicate, more sensational. In the first triad, the first two, the magicians could replicate. And I suspect that they could replicate it only in the sense that they could predict when these phenomena were going to happen. In this next three, the time is pinpointed. The time in which these will occur is indicated by Moses before it happens. Secondly, these plagues are focused on a particular group, on the Egyptians rather than the Israelites. So again, another factor of difficulty in pulling these off. They're more sensational. But at the same time, Pharaoh's resistance becomes more obstinate. And it becomes increasingly clear that his problem, his resistance, is not a matter of ignorance, but rather it's a matter of the will. And I think that we see that typically, that resistance to God and the things of God is not a lack of knowledge, but rather it is in fact a spiritual matter. I was thinking about these plagues, kind of tumbling it over in my mind, and I started wondering, why is it that God didn't do a more Star Trek kind of approach to this and just stun the Egyptians? And the Israelites could have fleeced them, could have taken all the wealth they wanted, and just walked out. Why did God choose this approach? Why these plagues? What's he doing here? What is added by taking this approach? The other one would be certainly sensational. What's he achieving by this kind of repetitive torment of the Egyptians? I'm not sure. But my suspicion is that he is showing us that he is working through Pharaoh to bring about his purposes. Here we have a human being who is adamantly opposed to what God wants to do. And yet God is going to take him through a series of experiences that is going to force Pharaoh against his will to do the very thing that God wants him to do. So instead of bypassing Pharaoh with a stun gun, he's going to affect Pharaoh through experiences such that Pharaoh is forced to do what God wants him to do. In other words, God is going to work through Pharaoh, despite Pharaoh's rebelliousness, to bring about God's purposes. That's an important thing to me, because when I think about it, at least 90% of the problems that I run into are relational. It's with other people. It's not the weather. It's not, my computer. It could be an exception, but Most the nagging problems, the problems that are persistent, the problems that are the most disconcerting, the most vexing, our relational problems. It's other people. And God is showing, I think, here that He is at work through people, even those who are obstinate against Him, who are trying to thwart His purposes. God still works through them to bring about His purposes. I can't help but recall the one of my favorite verses in the whole Bible from Genesis, at the conclusion of Genesis, where I think this is one of the strong themes that comes out in Genesis, in the story of Joseph, after having been sold into slavery by his brothers and having been subjected to a lot of unpleasantness in Egypt as a result of that unfair treatment, and then rising to the position of second in command of Egypt and being reunited with his brothers. His brothers were afraid, once the father died, that Joseph was going to use his power to get vengeance. And Joseph's response is in chapter 50, verse 19 and 20. But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? And as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. Therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So here Joseph has been brought through a series of experiences in which he comes to understand that, yes, his brothers meant to do him harm. They were downright nasty to him. They had evil intentions. But God was working through that whole situation and in control of that situation and working towards his own purposes. And those purposes were the outcome that we see in the end of Genesis. So God is capable of doing that, and in fact that is his mode of operation. Rather than eliminating the people that are problems in our lives, as sometimes we wish would happen, God's way of operating is to have those people in our lives be his tools in his hands to work his purposes in our lives. They aren't the problem then, ultimately. Even when they're being evil, even when they're trying to do harm to us, they are not ultimately the problem. They are ultimately God's tool working on us. And God is going to demonstrate through Pharaoh that here we have probably the most powerful man in the world, and one who is obstinately opposed to what God is trying to bring about. And yet, God is going to work him like putty in his hands and bring him to the place where he does the very thing that God intended all along. He's going to not only going to let the Israelites go, he's going to force them out, and they're going to plunder the Egyptians when they go. Questions, comments? Bob?
I'm not sure exactly how to put this. I'm a little unclear as to your perspective on the plagues. On the one hand, you've called them miracles. On the other hand, you've described them in such a way that they're a little more than glorified natural phenomena. I guess I'm wondering, What's the motivation for taking them any other way than just a straightforward statement of a miracle? Mm-hmm. Why would we want to see blood as just the color red? Mm-hmm. I mean, if the text wanted to describe the color red, that's right. Certainly possible. What? Right. Where is that coming from? Why would we want to do that?
In my mind, it doesn't make much difference. I mean, I'm convinced that God is capable of turning the water of the Nile literally into blood if he chooses to do so. My question is more, what is being described here? And here's where we come back to that issue of, is this poetic language such that the word blood is being used not to mean hemoglobin, but rather to mean, to be a poetic description of what the Nile looked like? In my mind, it's not a question of what God is capable of. It's more a question of what do we have, what is the author describing here? And if it is true that there are some natural phenomena that this could be describing, that's not a problem to me. It says that the magicians could do the same. It would be difficult for me to believe that the magicians of Egypt could literally turn the water of the Nile into hemoglobin.
Aren't there instances in the New Testament of magicians being able to do what appears to be miracles? I think of Simon,
I don't know if those are, or whether it's actually a miracle. My suspicion there is that it's a trick. And my suspicion is that here what the magicians were doing were tricks that in Pharaoh's mind were close enough to what Moses did to qualify it. Oh yeah, that's pretty good. That's doing it. But in each of the cases, I think Moses has done something that is more than what the magicians were capable doing. I think all the magicians were doing was predicting when this natural phenomenon would take place, that they know the signs of the times, and they knew when the floods would start, and could say, tomorrow the rivers of the Nile will be red. My suspicion is that that's the kind of replication that the magicians were performing. And Moses was predicting, I suspect, I think it might have been a natural phenomenon, that he was predicting it, but what's different is this one is of greater severity and such that it kills the fish, which was not something that the magicians could predict and bring about.
I guess I'm just wondering, given those two options, what would lead you in the direction of this being a description of natural phenomenon rather than straight out?
Well, this is something I do want to talk about more later. I need to think about it more. But I guess the question is, how does God typically operate? Even when he brings about miracles, how does God typically operate? What if God were to literally turn the water of the Nile into blood? What would be the ramifications of that? What would we hear from other literature, other accounts, something about this blood pouring into the Mediterranean turning red or whatever? I don't know. And that we need to talk about what is a miracle? What makes something miraculous? Mm-hmm. Margaret?
What's interesting to me is the number of times you do see God intervening, and it's the attitude of the writer is that it's clearly miraculous, and you also see that he's done it in a way that's natural. Like, wasn't there a time when there was the sound, supposedly the sound of tramping feet, it was just the wind in the trees or something like that? It does seem like he very rarely does it in a way that we would consider absolutely, positively miraculous. And I've often wondered, you know, even like multiplying loaves and fishes, he started with loaves and fishes and multiplied them. He didn't go, you know, and there you are.
Right.
I mean, he could have snapped his fingers and a table appeared with a whole feast on it, not simple loaves and fishes, which they're used to eating, which they started out with a few loaves and fishes anyway.
Mm-hmm.
He could, and I just wonder if he does that because for those people with eyes to see, they will recognize that this is a miracle. And for those people, well, with eyes to see, those people who don't have a moral problem and seeing the truth won't recognize a miracle for what it is. And those people with a moral problem, relative lack of spectacularness of it. Oh, this is some albeit unusual, but nevertheless natural phenomenon that can be explained and we don't have to be with God. And there's plenty of evidence in there to show its supernatural origin, but just enough naturalness to make those people who need the doubt that, to give them the ability to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Quite a number of the miracles that are described in the Old Testament have been similar things that have occurred that have been recorded in history. For instance, one that I can think of is the River Jordan, the flow stopping. That has happened twice in historic times, where the River Jordan has stopped, and apparently the area near the headwaters, near the outflow from the, what is the Sea of Galilee, is unstable. And from time to time there have been landslides that block off that water for extended periods of time until the water builds up behind it and then washes it out. So even if they are supernaturally brought about, quite a number of them have naturally occurring counterparts, apparently. Was there another question? Yes.
Do we know exactly how long or the time period happens between each plague? Because it appears that they're happening fairly close together.
We don't know. We don't know how long between the plagues. We know that the total period of time that the plagues are occurring extends over approximately 1 year. But how long between each plague is not indicated. Okay, thanks.